there are many challenges in Hawaii when it comes to climate change. Fortunately, there are also allies, sometimes in seemingly unlikely places. That's the case with our beaches and a biological byproduct of what's known by some as parrotfish and by others as the uhu. This is the topic of a piece today on Honolulu Civil Beat, and Civil Beat's politics and opinion editor Chad Blair is on the line with more. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Bill.
So it's not just the fish, but what they leave behind that's a focus.
Yeah, this is a Claire Caulfield story. It's terrific. I tell you, I learned something new every day from Civil Beat. You said parrotfish and uhu, right? The same thing. Well, Here's another way to think about them. The lawnmowers of the sea. And this is because the uhu, or the parrotfish, they have those big teeth, right? We've all seen them in the ocean. Well, something that I didn't think about until I read Claire's story is that what they do is they scrub seaweed from all the dead coral. That helps the corals regenerate and grow and, of course, allow for other fish populations to grow as well. But here's the catch. I did not know that what the fish then do, the uhu, their poop, their excrement actually is results in sand, very fine sand. And one single fish can generate 800 pounds of sand a year here in the islands. And of course, sand is very important given all of our troubles with erosion. And so, boy, talk about learning something new every day.
I was fascinated by this because it had never occurred to me. It makes sense when you step back. But then the downside of the story, though, is the threat that they're facing.
Right. And this is the whole point of the article, because it does go to climate change, because having our healthy reefs, they serve as barriers, help prevent storms and currents from eroding our beaches, and that's very important. But the fish are on the decline, the population of uhu, because they're very popular catches for local fishermen. This is particularly true on Oahu and the Big Island, and we are seeing significant drops in their populations because of overfishing. One of the people Claire talked to, a grad student at UH who actually runs a website about conserving uhu, says he describes it as bombing the reef. This is when scuba divers go out at night with their spear guns, and then they kill all the uhu in the area, and particularly when they're sleeping, because that's when the fish are so vulnerable.
You know, another point of education in this piece for me, too, was that spearfishing with scuba gear is illegal across much of the Pacific, and yet it is still legal in Hawaii.
Right. From much of Oceania, from American Samoa to Australia, you can't do that. It is allowed here. So what is being done about that? Well, there are some proposals. The Department of Land and Natural Resources, its aquatics division, they're looking at maybe having a night ban on fishing for uhu, but that hasn't happened yet. There's also talk about maybe considering a limit on the catch, right? A bag ban. As a matter of fact, Maui has something like that in place. They've had it for about 5 years. And if you're catching the uhu where you're not supposed to, there's going to be a fine. They can even seize your gear, your scuba gear, your spear gun. There's even no take zones. Like, don't go here. This is where you cannot take uhu. Could that be applied statewide? That is something that advocates for preserving uhu stock are pushing for.
And it seems like DLNR a bit cautious in terms of the idea of looking at this but not rushing to any sort of judgment.
Right. I mean, let's face it. Fishing is extremely popular here. It's an industry, and that's something you got to be careful about. You want to be able to strike a balance. But remember, these uhu are eating seaweed and invasive algae. They're allowing coral to thrive. They're protecting our beach from erosion. So maybe we ought to be more aware of the role that they play, and in fact, try and preserve these populations while balancing the needs of fishermen.
Civil Beat's politics and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check about Claire Caulfield's story on protecting our reefs and beaches. Chad, thanks very much.
Anytime, Bill. Thank you.
And you can read that full story at civilbeat.org. Staying with that theme of climate change is going to have an impact on every one of our islands. And on this island, there's an example that's undergoing review right now that's sort of a case study, not only in the challenges of climate change, but also how to approach them. It's about flood control in some of the densest neighborhoods of Honolulu. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has been following the story and joins us more with now.
Hey, Bill.
Hey.
Yeah, this is the Alawai Flood Control Project. A lot of folks have probably heard about it. And as you mentioned, it sounds like, because of the name Alawai, that it's about specifically the Alawai Canal, but it actually refers to the Alawai Watershed.
Much broader.
Yeah, much broader. It includes some of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Honolulu: Waikiki, Makaeli Mo'ili'ili, Palolo, Makiki, and Manoa Valleys. And it actually, the name Alawai refers to a geographic area in which any water that falls from rain or from a stream eventually drains into the Alawai Canal and the ocean in front of it. And so there are these watersheds all over the Hawaiian Islands. Some of them kind of conform with an Ahupua, and some of them are broader, and they're on all over the mainland too, on different continents. Some of them are really big on the mainland because it's a huge continent, and here they can be a lot smaller, and they kind of follow mountain ridges and that sort of thing. And this project has been kicking around since the 1990s to create some kind of flood control protection for the Alawai watershed, because it does encompass some of these really densely populated and really economically productive areas of Honolulu. And in 2018, the federal government produced some funding to fund this project, to get it started. It was part of a series of flood remediation and flood protection projects from all over the country. This was just one of them. And it was managed by the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the federal agency. It's under the Department of the Army, and there are uniformed Army soldiers, but it's mostly civilian engineers. And they oversee the nation's waterways, locks,
and
rivers.
Tasked with also, you think of the New Orleans floods and the Army Corps of Engineers involved.
Yeah, levees, that kind of thing, canals. They've done those kind of projects for a long time, since the Jefferson administration, actually. Thomas Jefferson, that is. And so they were going to be designing this project, and it was designed to protect these areas from a major flood event, like the kind we saw in Hanalei in 2018 that was called a rain bomb. And it also hit East Honolulu, so the next watershed over, actually, from the Alawai one. And the Army Corps of Engineers projects that a flood like that, a rain event like that, in the Alawai watershed could cause over $1 billion worth of damage. Yeah, thousands of properties and businesses could be affected. And their modeling shows that the bottom of the bowl, is what the project manager called it, is Makaeli Mo'ili'ili. So that's where most of the water would settle. For comparison, the Hanalei rain bomb dropped 50 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. That's so over 4 feet of water coming down, which was a new national record and remains a new national record, more than any hurricane or tropical storm, just from that one event, $125 million in damage. And that type of storm is what this project is supposed to protect against. And we know that these storms are increasing in frequency and severity, in part due to climate change, but the damages are also worse because of human impacts on the land that prevent water from absorbing in naturally. And I talked about that with Josh Stanbro. He's the chief resiliency officer for the city and county of Honolulu, and that's a recently created office that oversees climate change adaptation.
The irony is this project came about because the entire watershed has been hardened. So whether it's driveways or streets or hardened streams, that water doesn't soak in any longer. 100-year storms may happen every year come 2050. We saw in Houston, there was 3 500-year storms in 18 months.
So you can hear there that there's sort of this two-pronged effect, that human development has made rain events more damaging, and the rain events themselves are becoming stronger and more frequent. And that's kind of why policymakers feel like the time is now to act on this. But a lot of members of the community are not really happy with the plan that was produced by the Corps of Engineers. They want to build several detention basins. The exact location is kind of in flux right now. Originally, they were going to be in Pololo and Makiki that would collect this rainwater. So not necessarily dams that are permanently holding back water, but when a big rain event comes, they would slow down the flow of water so that it could be kind of dispersed at a lower rate and not cause damage. But the people who live in those areas weren't very enthusiastic about having these basins. They were worried of, you know, what could go wrong if they weren't maintained, that it could make a flood worse in that area. Also, there were some flood walls planned for the Alawai Canal itself that a lot of canoe paddlers didn't care for. And so this kind of general opposition to the design itself, not to the concept of flood protection, but the way that the Corps of Engineers wants to do it, is kind of being led by this group called Protect Our Alawai Watershed. Sydney Lynch, who's a Pololo resident, created it, and I went and spoke with her at her office in Kalihi just to kind of get a feel for what some of their concerns are.
I've lived on the stream for almost 25, 30 years, and you know, we see it when it's during the winter when there's a lot of water, and we see the area where it really doesn't really go above. And I understand that with the climate change and rain bombs, that if it rains, you know, very hard for a short period of time, or you know, that you could have a lot of water coming down. But again, like I said, in the last 25, 30 years, we've seen a bunch of water come down. So when they started saying that this massive structure needed to be built, it was just kind of like, why? Where are they getting the information? And you could have your big flood and then your basin could fail. Will this happen? No. But there is a possibility. And if you're living directly downstream from that, that's something that's really in your mind all the time. You feel so powerless because nobody's listening and they dismiss you as like a NIMBY. Well, I'm not a NIMBY, but I will be living with the effects of this.
So there are kind of two things she mentioned that are important. One is that there's sort of skepticism, I would say, about the actual need for the project. People wanted to know where the you know, the data is coming from. But then also they feel like they're not being listened to and their concerns are not being heard. And that comes into play because this local company, Oceanet, they're kind of a design and technology firm, was contracted by the city council to basically look at alternatives to what the Corps of Engineers put forward. Founded by Patrick Sullivan, he's a PhD in electrical engineering, and he champions this method of problem solving called design thinking that was created at Stanford University. And it's just basically a five-step process for how to approach a problem and solve it. And step one is actually empathize. And so Pat has been is starting to hold community meetings, and he said that step one for him is going to be listening, and he kind of heralds this as listening first before designing as a totally new way of approaching these projects that he says we'll need to do.
The way these projects get introduced and the way they get solved has to evolve like anything else. I was visiting the guys at the D School there at Stanford. What they're trying to do is introduce into the curriculum a degree on bringing complex projects to communities, because this is a problem we're going to be living with in the modern world. And it's not really addressed in traditional approaches of planning and architecture and that kind of thing. And I think as the communities have become denser, as things like social media, where communications are different, it is becoming more important to think about it and to put together a discipline on how to do this.
Sullivan actually told me that for that first meeting, the one I attended, he didn't even bring engineers. He just brought design thinkers, as he said, to basically there, rather than the traditional approach of here's an engineering problem, how can we solve it? They're going to kind of listen to the human side of things first and then produce a design that hopefully addresses a lot of those human concerns before producing a design and alleviate some of the tension.
And one of the key aspects of design thinking of taking into account the end user, sort of starting at the end and working backwards rather than projecting something that is pre-cooked.
Yeah, and that's sort of what he was clear to say. He doesn't think that the Army Corps of Engineers has any ill will or anything like that, but that they kind of took a more traditional design first and then present, and he's trying to flip that equation
different,
a little
bit. Different approach. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure thing.
HPR's Ryan Finnerty. You can read his story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And tomorrow, look for a follow-up story from Ryan on applying design thinking to some complex projects with an eye to adapting to climate change.